And our first panel discussion is from Rohana Supersingi from FAO, and he's going to talk on protecting small-scale farmers, a reality within a globalised economy. So let me introduce Rohana. So Rohana's a senior aquaculture officer with the Fisheries and Aquaculture section of FAO. He specialised in aquaculture disease control and health management, particularly microbiology and immunology, and he's worked in all parts of the world, mostly within Asia. He's been a former teacher from University of Colombo and UPM in Malaysia. He earned his PhD in zoology from the University of Colombo, an MSc from the University of Plymouth, and PhD from Stirling. So he's travelled widely in his educational pursuits as well. Rohana has been responsible for initiating major policy changes in aquatic health management in relation to aquaculture in the region and globally. He's a founding member of the Fish Health Section of the Asian Fisheries Society, and he currently serves as Technical Secretary to the Subcommittee on Aquaculture on the Committee of Fisheries of the FAO. Rohana, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the podium this afternoon.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm short. Good afternoon, everybody. Before I go into the topic, in your program, under this, with this time, you have two parallel sessions. One based on Dr. Gupta's presentation on enabling contribution to aquaculture poverty alleviation. The other one is based on the improving knowledge information by Dr. Gary Jensen. Immediately after this presentation, on the other side, there will be a presentation by Dr. Mike Phillips, who is sitting over here. He will talk about servicing the aquaculture sector. Once again, as we say, 80% of the aquaculture sector is small scale. Definitely you're going to hear some repetitions between me and Mike, because servicing also part that will require in making, protecting the small farmers. So therefore there will be little, you might see a bit repetition, but please excuse me for that because you are listening to me first. Now, the title given to me is Protecting Small-Scale Farmers, a Reality Within a Globalized Economy. And we heard quite a bit about it already after Dr. Gupta's presentation, and also the discussion that touched upon how important the small-scale sector is. Now, this group, we have a big group, and some of them are here, and you will see them after my presentation for the discussion. If you could remember, the Bangkok Declaration of Strategy, which was adopted in 2010 in Bangkok, did we talk about small-scale, protecting small-scale farmers? If you look at carefully, we didn't. So does that mean something happened since 2000? Probably yes. The global economic changes and various trade changes which took place maybe after 2000 made us to talk about how vulnerable the small-scale sector and how important the small-scale sector, but the importance came because they became vulnerable. So if you look at carefully, you have two articles in the Bangkok Declaration and Strategy, which says improving food security and alleviating poverty. We talk about small-scale farming, but we didn't talk about protecting them. And also we had integrating aquaculture into rural development. We also said that rural development, aquaculture can bring into rural development so that it will create opportunities for employment, livelihoods, and diverse livelihoods for people in the rural communities. But we didn't talk about that they had trouble. But let's move. This graph is familiar to you. You've seen it yesterday. You've seen it the day before. What it shows is that how important the aquaculture sector is, how the growth of the aquaculture sector. I'm not going to go any details into that. I'm sure you by heart this graph by now. This graph is interesting. That came from my colleague over there, Dr. Arun Lem. That talks the world fish trade export value in $1,000. You can see how important the fish trade in the world, both for developing countries as well as developed countries. Don't ask me what happened in 2008, why there is a dent. We will ask it from Dr. Lem later on. But having said that, in general, trade increased both in developing countries and developed countries. And it is increasing, and it has become, if I'm not wrong, in the developing countries, probably the most valuable traded commodity, exported commodity is fish now. If you look at the future, once again, you heard from Mr. Jia, very first day, that we now have 52.5 million tons of fish that we produce, and also Dr. Olf, many of them. And according to, and this account for about 37% of the fishery products produced worldwide. And that accounts for 46% of the fish, the food fish that we consume at the moment. So in other words, as we said earlier, in maybe in 2 years' time, we can say with confidence that one out of every two fish you eat come from aquaculture. We are just there, it'll be in 2 years. We heard, yes, a little while ago, there was a question about this 30 million tons, right? The estimates can be a bit different. Never mind, the important thing is that we need more fish. We need a lot more fish. That's the message. And then second message is it has to come from aquaculture, because we do not see any increase, significant increase in the production or the capture fishery production over the coming decades. Therefore, that 30 million, if you're talking about now 52 million, more than 50% over the next 20 years has to come from aquaculture. And I say that small scale is important because Dr. Gupta said in his presentation 80% of the aquaculture are small scale. Therefore, if you want to produce another 30 million, more than 50% of what we have now in 20 years' time, the small scale sector is extremely important. In generally, global economic trends, if you take it through very fast, number of people in poverty declined over the past 10 years. That's for sure. But global poverty increased. This is a little bit complicated, but if you look at over 1 billion people are below the poverty line. There was Dr. Gupta said 950 million. And we have a new motto on our website, 1 billion hungry, right? And with a yellow whistle that we whistle and say that we understand 1 billion hungry. There are several emerging major economies in the world, China, India, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil. And then there is a lot of going on with corporate farming in aquaculture, in general in agriculture. Now, when we talk about globalization, the globalization generally leads to many things. I'm not an economist, but in my understanding, globalization, worldwide marketing of goods and services, increased economies of scale due to globalization because you have no boundaries, basically, with little boundaries in trading. And globalization supports corporate governance. You can see it from many, many sectors, many production sectors, and many industries. However, the little information we have and the experience, the small-scale producers are slowly pushed out of business because of the competition of the globalization, because you compete with the corporate sector and through corporate governance. Now, what is small-scale aquaculture? In this discussion and this presentation, we decided the group to call a small-scale aquaculture, although well not defined, but considered here to encompass a spectrum of household managed farming activities, ranging from subsistence farmers to more commercially oriented micro and small-scale enterprises. Small-scale aqua farmers are characterized by various characteristics. Small land and water areas that they use, or family-scale operations or businesses, if you want to say, often using family labor, often based on family land. Because of the family land, every generation you decline the land, therefore your next generation has less. For an example, 240 million agriculture farmers with less than 1 hectare is operating in China alone in agriculture sector, not in aquaculture, agriculture sector. They are extremely vulnerable because they are small, and either they own or they are leased, but they are small. So, if you look at the definition of small-scale aquaculture, don't ask me, we are good at definitions in FAO, but unfortunately we just don't have one for this one yet. Resource poor individuals or groups of people involved in small-scale aquaculture production, that is aquaculture production facilities and process, small production volume and or relatively small surface area, and typically lacking, please, the last three words, typically lacking technical and financial capacity. That will be the focus of the next 20 minutes. Lacking technical and financial capacity. So small-scale aquafarmers, as we said, 80%, an estimated 12 million. Dr. Gupta said 13 million. I said 12 million. Somebody might say 14 million. That's why I put a question mark at the end. We just don't know, honestly. I think we need to understand how big this sector is. We are still struggling to understand. This is one of the recommendations from this group, I believe, is a better understanding of the sector, the small-scale sector, and how big it is and how important it is in terms of not qualitatively but quantitatively, if at all possible. Major contributors to production in many countries, major contributors to global farm fish supply, as we said, it comes from the majority, coming from the majority. And they are highly innovative sector. Why? Because, you know, they have to do things by themselves. Important for rural development, communities, employment, poverty reduction, environmental sustainability, because they are small and they are not sophisticated. They are always with the nature. Therefore, they are environmentally sustainable. A part of our international commitment towards the Millennium Development Goal, which we have, the first goal is eradicating extreme poverty and hunger. When we have 1 billion people under the poverty line, and if 80% of the aquaculture is done by the small-scale farmers, we have that responsibility to ensure that they continue to do so. Not to keep them in poverty though, but they are not going below the poverty so that we contribute to the Millennium Development Goal. The current trends in market and is the present trends international market is not really working, is working against the small-scale sector, unfortunately. The commodity price is declining, cost of production is increasing, value of the energy price, fuel price, all going up. Changes in cost and business structure of aquaculture is changing. Cost of business is changing. Structure of business is changing. But they can adopt because they are small. Risk management strategies by the big corporate systems, the small farmers cannot adopt. They are strong, they have the capital, so they can come up with any risk management strategies to protect themselves. But the small farmers, they cannot. Easier for big buyers to deal with big farms, but with large volumes. But for small people, they always go by small produce. Market access is difficult because you are a small producer. Who wants to buy? Yes, I will buy, but make sure that you give me 1,000 tons a week. For the next 2 years, I will buy 1,000 tons a week. Unfortunately, this guy only produced 2 kilos a day. So he cannot do it. So small firms, farmers are basically being hurt by the way the industry is moving, by the way the sector is moving. If you look at this coming from my friend Dominique from Aquastar, that's the price of low margin. You can see the low margin of Penes Venomai in Thailand. In Thai baht, you can see the black line and how the prices fluctuate. If anything goes below the black line, small farmer is out. If it's below the black line, a big farmer can still afford because it will go up again. But with a small one, he survives with every single harvest. So he cannot. If you look at this one, low productivity. This is small farmers, again, large farms. If you look at the productivity, unfortunately, small farmer, always small producer. So he cannot compete in the market. Why? Because his produce is small. Therefore, individually, singly, he is always at the mercy of the market. Can they adapt? Well, capacity to adapt to small also constrained by the special features of small-scale aquaculture sector. There are certain features, as we said. Inadequate access to financial resources to invest in any change. Even if you want to expand your pond a little bit, even if you want to improve it a little bit, who's going to give them money? You cannot get a loan from the bank because it's too small. You cannot find a collateral. Inadequate access to markets, technical and business knowledge. Who is going to give them the knowledge? Who is going to give them the services, which will be dealt by Mark next after this presentation? Even the institutional policy orientation in many countries are not necessarily favorable for small farmers. Although we made some improvements over the past 10 years by putting small-scale sector into the planning process and policy, and also we have PRSPs in the countries, yet it's necessarily very favorable. So commercial government services are also less oriented toward the small farmers. They really can't participate in any of these things that are done by in the sector. So with all that, can they manage? I said they are highly innovative. Are there ways in sort of aquaculture farmers to participate in the modern market chain? Recent experiences, which I'm not going to go into detail. I believe Mike will take it up next presentation. The experiences that of working with small farmers in India, in Vietnam, in Thailand, and various ways and various mechanisms of working with the farmers. Recent experiences show positive pro-small-scale farmer action can result in positive benefits. I'm not going to show you any dollar figures, but I'm sure Mike will talk about the services. But having said that, organization of farmers into producer groups, what we call clusters, which you heard over the past 2 days, have been shown probably the way forward, not a way forward. I think it's probably the only way that you can make them survive. And organizing farmers will allow certification of groups, which is a question that it's been discussed, allows economies of scale, because one person who produces 2 kilos cannot go to market, but if you organize them into 100, you will produce 200 kilos. Of course, if you expand a little bit, then you can make it even bigger so that you have a bargaining power. So you can say that, look, our produce is this much, therefore you have to recognize us. Then you have the facilitates communication extension, because you are bringing a group of farmers together into a cluster. Individually, you don't talk to them, but as a group, they will talk. The better management. One single person operates a little farm, and his effluents are going in somewhere. The other, it may be go to another farm, or maybe go to the waterways, which the other farmer takes. But if you bring 50 farmers together and make sure that the effluents are all collected and gone in one direction, and it is not going to contaminate, and you're basically reducing the risks of disease and risks of other environmental problems. Therefore, better management of the system, and it'll help them. It'll keep them going. And certainly, it facilitates organized marketing. We have experience on that. Some of the clusters that in India work by the MPIDA and NACA, and also some of our assistants, is shown that very clearly big buyers are coming directly to purchase from well-organized clusters. So individually, farmers will face increasing difficulties to market access. However, as I said, the farmers, once you organize them as to clusters, they will definitely have a better market access. Okay. Public investments are needed for the small-scale sector. Otherwise, we have to really make sure that the public investment is going in their sector. Policy favorable to the small-scale sector is important. If it is not happening, we should encourage the governments to go into, as required, of course, a policy favorable policies. Supporting farmer group formations, technical and marketing services for small-scale aquaculture producers, which is, once again, as I said, will probably be dealt in detail next speech. Another 4 areas is market access for small-scale producers, information services, financial services, and encouraging private investment in small-scale aquaculture. Extremely difficult. Not very much private investment coming in small scale. But if you still want to start your old corporate systems, they are not new. They're the same old stories, but you need to bring them again into reality. The social safety nets, as I said, they are vulnerable, but you need to create some social safety nets to take them out of vulnerability. Educational technical institutions oriented towards small-scale farming. Most of the technical institutions, they cannot go to school. They don't go to universities. But we need to create some of these things which are create towards the small-scale farming sector. Trade rules and guidelines that consider needs of the realities of the small-scale sector. If you go to the Doha round of discussion, said that there should be a preferential treatment for developing countries when you discuss the WTO standards. Similarly, we always should think of the small-scale sector as an underprivileged sector, therefore we give some preferential treatment. International cooperation across the market chain is required. Not only across the market chain, international cooperation is required. Okay, business investment is also needed, not only public investment. And there are many opportunities for private investors and investment to support small-scale farmers, microfinance services, technical and marketing services, information, as I said, and import packaging and delivery. Now, we talk about certification. I think this discussion was sometime today and also yesterday. And the certification will very likely improve and increase the market access to many. And the tested certification and quality assurance schemes relevant to small-scale producers should be promoted. Tested. Most of them probably won't work for them. Now, the crucial role of small-scale aquaculture farmers in aquaculture production and trade should be recognized. This is the message that we can take from here. The small-scale sector is the largest aquaculture producing sector and the mainstream of the communities in many parts of the world, particularly in Asia, as we are producing, Asia is producing 90% of the globe. It is an innovative sector, as I said, but faced with the many problems and constraints in the modern trade and market environment. It needs investment for public and private sector to complete and thrive in the modern aquaculture scene. The sector is socially and economically significant. As I said, it is our social responsibility, and it should not be ignored, and it cannot be ignored and forgotten. There is a corporate social responsibility for all of us, for the large-scale sector and all of us, to facilitating market access for small-scale, provision of technical and financial assistance to small-scale, and favorable brand development and many other things which will help. As if you read the book, The Building Social Business by Professor Yunus, he talks about the social business, how important the social capital, social aspects of a business. It is our responsibility, the protecting small-scale farmers. The title of my presentation will become a reality if we all have the will to make a change. The ones who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones that do. Thank you.
Thank you, Rahana. We've got time for some a panel discussion now. We have half an hour, so I'd like the panel to assemble here. So let me just explain. With each of these panel sessions, the lead panelist, Rahana, will provide a list of recommendations that will be discussed tomorrow afternoon. So any sort of points of questions, let's do the discussion first. But bear in mind that if you have any recommendations about small-scale aquaculture, please make sure we record those. So let me call for discussions. Yes, please, in the centre.
Thank you for this presentation. I'm Rubaiyat from Bangladesh, so I think I can share a bit lot about this topic. The question that I want to raise to the panel is that you talked about forming farmer groups as associations as an alternative or as a solution to build their capacity, bargaining power, and et cetera, market access, et cetera. But the question is how to form these farmer groups? Now, will it be the government doing it, or will it be some NGOs doing it? You proposed about public fund, and I suppose some of it will go on building the farmer groups. But the point is, in our experience, we have seen that a lot of these farmer groups have not sustained, and we have to understand why. And the reason being that we have bombarded them with so many works that a social organization will not be able to do because these farmers have other jobs to do. They have to be in the field. So in practice, we find it difficult to implement that. So I'd be interested to learn from you because it's across, you're an international panel bridging in all the learnings from different countries. It will be interesting for us to learn, the practitioners, how to really form the farmer groups which are sustainable and which can go beyond project boundaries. Because, one project can only form 100 to 200 farmer groups, but we need thousands of farmer groups across the country. So we need solutions from you on how to work on that. Thank you.
Thank you. I think you should hear from the horse's mouth. So I'm going to pass the microphone to someone who probably pioneered the putting farmers together into clusters in India. But I must tell you that, although I said everything in 25 minutes, it's a very long and painful process. Arun.
Well, this is nothing to do with the technical issue, actually, the grouping the farmers. It's a basically social engineering issue. How we work with the farmers, how we glue them together, because we have to tell them, whoever takes that job of facilitating the farmer groups, they have to give all these reasons why they have to be united for their self-existence for sustainable production as well as sustainable income for their own existence. And long-term commitment of any government, local government, that is also very important. Most of the projects are short-term oriented, say 1 or 2 years, then they disappear. It can't work. You have to commit yourself, and a dedicated team at the grassroots level is extremely important. Most of the times, extension work, you see, office-based, they may not go to the field. So it is very important to know the pulse of people, what they want. See, we have discussed a lot of issues with extension this afternoon also. We have to, basically the team has to dedicate itself, 24/7, for the service of the farmers for the long term. Then only all these things can be very successful and sustainable.
Okay, just have we got more panel members to discuss? Look, let me. I've just got a little announcement to make first. I've just received from the Secretariat, and Mr. Wei Hing Chang and Mubarak Isa Abdul Rahman. Could they, if they're in the audience, could they contact the Secretariat, please? So let us proceed with the discussion. I'm sorry.
I'm Lina Nair, Chairman MPDA. In fact, this first experiment which we were talking about has actually the initiative of MPDA, which is a commerce ministry outfit with the government of India. It's called Marine Product Export Development Authority. And under this authority, we constituted a society. A society was formed under the Societies Act, which was called NAGSA. We were guided, of course, by the initial experiments which took place under the guidance of NACA. And there was a lot of governmental support through MPDA for this whole project, and it is still ongoing. We have about 12,000 farmers enrolled in about 540 societies all over the country now, all over the coastal area. It was initially started in the state of Andhra Pradesh in one state so that we could have a concentrated eye on how things are going, meet all the problems which came up. And as Arun said, it was motivating, training, and a lot of social engineering which went to get a whole group of farmers to act together. They had to act together to see how, we had to first show them how it was beneficial to act together. And then, right from how the pond is formed, how they should register with MPDA, how they should operate the SOPs, what were the SOPs, how should they select the seed, all this had to be taught and monitored. And there was a band of dedicated group which went into this. We were sure of their credentials. We were also sure that they were actually going to these farms and going and monitoring them and seeing whether the preparation of the farms, etc., was in order. And now we have reached a level where initially there was an incidence of 80% disease. Now there is a incidence of less than 18% disease. So that's how the farmer has seen a better crop, a better yield, and a better price. And that has gone a long way, in as was said by one of the speakers earlier, a farmer-farmer communication which has led this to be replicated in other districts of other states of India. Thank you.
Thank you, Lena. We've got a question there, I think, was the second one.
Hi, Simon Bush from Simon Bush from Barkening University. Thanks very much for the presentation. We've been involved with Anyang University in Vietnam working with Pangasius farmers. So I just had a few reflections on the presentation in regards to Pangasius. It's an interesting statement, I think, that, you know, farmer clusters are definitely going to lead to improved market access. We found that the horizontal formation, let's say, between farmers has also been a painful process, but possible. But over the long term, what we found was that there was really the vertical relationships. It was that relationship with the processing companies which was the make or break of the group. So I wouldn't mind if we could hear a little bit more about how you overcame or dealt with that vertical relationship to processing companies. Now, with the Pangasius case, just to share very quickly, it's basically a situation where you have an 80-20 split. You have 80% of the production from 20% of the producers. So for a lot of the processing companies, small-scale producers remain somewhat of a problem. It's an add-on to the stock which they get from their own production or from the larger production farms. So I'm very interested to share and hear how you've been dealing with that in the case of India.
Thank you. I think I'm also going to pass the microphone to someone else, because we do have experience, a similar experience with shrimp and also with tilapia on a vertical integration in and selling mainly to main buyers, you know, sort of in Europe. Mike, you want to say anything about Aceh in India?
Okay, thank you, Rohana, and thank you, Simon, for the question. I think your question also illustrates that there are differences between the context where people are working. In the shrimp case, both in India and Aceh, the effort went into the horizontal cooperation first, and that was very successful because farmers made more money from that horizontal cooperation. There was an attempt to make the vertical connection fairly early on, but that was extremely difficult for shrimp because there wasn't sufficient product quantity and coming together with the required internal control systems to attract the buyers. So it was the horizontal that worked very well, and only now this connection to buyers is starting to come together. Because the groups are functioning well. Perhaps Pangasius may be different because there's a huge volume of Pangasius that perhaps makes it more interesting for buyers. In terms of processing companies, yes, many processing companies view small-scale farmers as problems, and we need to look at ways of moving beyond that sort of perception. I don't want to say something a little bit about the sustainable seafood trend, and I think what we're seeing with the buyers, and perhaps driven by markets asking for sustainable seafood, is this pushing out of many of the small-scale producers. I think the end result will be small-scale producers out, ponds abandoned, jobs lost, so not very sustainable situation for many people and for the environment. And then we'll have sustainable seafood on supermarket shelves in Europe. And I think that label would be totally inappropriate to that situation. So I think we've got to look beyond some of the individual labeling and certification schemes. We need more responsibility from the buyers and the retailers to really look for solutions in this part of the sector. And only then, when we broadly have sustainability across the sector, will we be able to put product onto supermarket shelves and claim it is sustainable seafood.
Thank you. Now, Ram, you had a question. I think you were the next one.
I'm Ram from Asian Institute of Technology, Bangkok. And it's not a question, but I would like to share what we have been doing regarding this sustainability of the group. We started actually a small project in Nepal and forming a women's group. So women normally they stay at home. Men or boys, they go out to work. So we train the women. And then they actually help each other. And how they do is they have regular meeting and one help each another. And then when they started farming fish and they actually have like a monthly some money saved for the group. And also when they have fish harvest and they have some money to accumulate. And then later on they were converted to cooperative. And then when it was cooperative, then they actually had a bargaining power with the government. And government actually started looking after them because when there is any subsidy or there is any, even they provided like a leadership training and then also accounting also. So among the women, one or two persons were really good in leading the group. And then that's how they were empowered. And then we use that group again to expand our project in other districts, other places. So that's how they are actually going themselves rather than we are pulling them. And then recently we have been running like a aquaculture with our Frontiers project, which funds like a small amount of grants. With that, we are forming more and more groups. And then this is a project. So we cannot continue forever. And then when they are a group in a cooperative, so they are attached with the government, local government or other organizations. So that's how it can continue forever. So that's our experience. Thank you.
Thank you, Ram. The third row there back. Yes, you've been waiting for some time.
Good afternoon. Congratulations, Rohana, on your presentation and to the panel members. My name is Javier Martinez Cordero from Mexico. I have had the opportunity before in several meetings and in Rome to share this, what I'm going to say about our Mexican experience with producers, organizations, and the incorporation of the organizations in the supply chains, which I guess is the critical point. It's not only to organize the producers, but to incorporate these producers now organized in the supply chain procedures of decision making. So they really are able to incorporate their decisions, their opinions in the supply chain, actually decisions, and they can access, for example, better prices, gain market shares, etc. That's important, I guess. It's not only to organize the producers, but to try to incorporate the producer organizations then to the supply chain and have a seat in the supply chain meetings, whatever, if they are organized as in this form. So they really can raise their voice to represent their interests. Of course, when we are dealing with organizations, we have to start to think and be prepared to help in some other things, like, for example, organizations will have to be analyzed how decisions are taken within the organizations, if they are representative, how hidden interests within the organizations are incorporated. So this is a very different field. But I guess in the future, and I strongly agree with what Rohana said, this is not a way forward. This is probably the way forward for small producers. And we have to be prepared in our fields to support this organization formation, but also incorporation as an improvement, because they will have to learn how to do that. And I think the first ones who have to be motivated in organizing are themselves. I mean, it's going to be rather difficult that we force them to do it. They will learn and they will understand at some point that the motivation has to be from their side to organize and go on.
It's not really response to this one. I just response to previous questions, basically. So regarding who is going to really make this clustering approach works, I believe it's basically everybody get roles to play. So no individual groups can really make this one work. So basically, in terms of grass-level work like an NGO and the local community, they can really work with farmers to organize the small farmers. But the public sector, that has a very important role to play in order to make that sustainable. Basically, the public service has to change to adapt to this kind of approach. So that means there's special mechanism should be developed, established to really to facilitate the cluster approach. So that is one thing I believe, because like in Thailand, we are working now with a group certification program. So basically, at initial stage, we are working on how to organize the farmers to have this cluster really effectively organized. At the same time, the Department of Fisheries, they're also working on how to really bridge these clusters to link with the market, how to follow up with these good services. That's, I think, it's kind of a way to work out. And regarding this vertical linkage, that is also very important. And basically, particularly talking about this marketing linkage, it's mainly processing marketing. So there are some like experiences in the region, like in China. So government are taking some different approach to public sector facilitate. One is to improve the marketing infrastructure, so with the government support. So then the public, some sort of investment, their aim to really to facilitate, to build up like a very easy accessible wholesale market, so the farmers have no need to travel very long distance and can easily market the products. Another thing is government is also supporting some like establishment of processing plant in those agriculture area. So with this development of this processing plant company, then they can facilitate the benefit the farmers. So that's my
Mohan from NACA. Just one point to touch upon. I think there was some discussion on the incentives for farmers to come together. From the India experience, I think, which Arun missed, is the primary driver. In India, thanks to white spot disease, that was the primary driver. Farmers knew, acting alone, they just cannot survive. They have to come together. If they come together, they can survive. That was the primary driver, and that was the right opportunity for the intervention. And thanks to the excellent work done by the field team, led by Arun and supported by MPEDA. But the primary driver was disease. So that's where it brought unity. In Vietnam, catfish now, maybe the primary driver is price, market price. If they come together, maybe there's a better way, you know, to better market or get sold. So I think we need to identify the primary drivers and then use that to facilitate the formation. Thank you.
Recognition of a benefit. Okay, let's have a question here, please.
I'm Thomas Moss Paulson from FAO and former chief advisor for Mimensing Aquaculture Extension Project, with an outreach of 600,000 families in the greater Mimensing area. And my experiences with the formation of farmer groups is very good and very, very simple. We had 500 trainers and trainers of trainers, and the formation of the group was simply a technical question that we could only, of course, train a group if there was a group, because we could not go out man to man because the outreach was too little then. And the formation of the group, the participation of the group was a must in order to obtain microcredit, because as everybody knows, that the return of the credit is much higher if you have a group, because everybody guarantees for each other. Mm. So that was straightforward. Everybody knew that, and that was simply a must in order to get the credit. Mm. When first the group has been formed and the message has given, the technology has been there, I think later on we saw that the outreach actually went from mouth to mouth. So the training within the group, the knowledge within the group was maybe not that important any longer, unless you wanted to have further credit. But the formation as such was easy and no problem.
Thank you. Any response from the panel?
Yeah, there have been a couple of references to the Bangladesh. I also worked in Bangladesh for a number of years on fisheries projects. And these are projects financed by the World Bank. And we also toyed with these concept of farmers group, shrimp farmers group in particular. But the unfortunate part is that these groups were not sustainable after the project closed. You know? And I sort of wondered, you know, why is it that the India model is working and why is it that in Bangladesh it hasn't? You know? And what, the message that I want to emphasize here is that we have to look at what are the lessons learned. You know? I sort of listed three or four. You know? One is that in the India case, there's clear commitment by the government, you know. Whereas in case of Bangladesh and maybe in other countries, you know, once the project is closed, there's no sort of sustainability, you know. And most of these donor-funded projects, as we all know, there's nothing new, you know, have NGOs to support farmers group. So NGOs, after the project closes, do not have funds, they also sort of walk away, you know. And this has not happened in case of in the model, you know. Second, in case, maybe in a probably 4 or 5 points over here, but it'll be very brief. In projects in Bangladesh and elsewhere, you have, you know, multi-focus, you know, projects. For example, it's like a Christmas tree. You have shrimp, you have fish, you have construction of buildings, research, and all whatnot. Whereas in the India model, I see the focus is on shrimp farmers, you know, providing all sorts of assistance to them. The third one is, the projects are time-bound, 4 years, 5 years, and donors, including World Bank, although I work as a staff of the World Bank, we are under extreme pressure, you know, to show some results, you know. The social results do not come within such a short period. You have to have at least 10, 15 years, which again is the case of the India model, you know. They're probably in the 8th year or so, you know. And the other point that I want to touch on is that it has to be localized, you know. You can't have a group here and a group there, you know, and then form them all, you know, under one sort of association. Again, India model is the small farmers are located in one particular area. In fact, there's a GIS map which shows the location of the clusters, you know. So I think what we need to sort of take from this particular presentation is what are the lessons learned that could be sort of implemented in other countries, you know. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Peter Edwards from the Asian Institute of Technology. Let me just carry on where Dr. Imtiaz left off. Lessons learned and case studies. Okay, common knowledge, aquaculture is dominated by small-scale farmers in Asia. Okay, we need data to back that one up. That's a recommendation. But if there's so many small-scale farmers, they can't all be struggling. So we need to document existing practice in countries where aquaculture is well established and has been going for years. And I'll just give one example here. It's West Java, where there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of small-scale farmers who are successfully mainly producing seed. They're not in clusters, they're in networks. And these have not been set up by the government either. These have been evolved through the private sector. There's usually a big shot involved. For a higher value species, he will own a hatchery and supply the eggs or the fry, maybe some credit. He will distribute these to the smaller farmers, and he will collect back the fingerlings, and then he'll sell them on. And this seems to work very well. For lower value species, like common carp and tilapia, the small scale guys breed as well as being linked up in networks. And the small-scale guys are basically in seed production now in Indonesia. I'm talking inland now, in West Java. They are not involved to a large extent in grow-out. That is the bigger guys, because it requires a lot of money to buy the feed. It's mainly in cages in West Java now, in the reservoirs. The small-scale guys have moved out of pond production. I've talked to some of them. They're in nursing. It requires less capital investment. There's a good cash flow, and it's much more profitable for them with their small areas of land. So the message I want to get across is we need to document good existing practice. There's so much of it, but it's not been described. And we can learn, as Dr. Imtiaz says, there's a lot of lessons learned here about how to set these up. Not necessarily through projects. These things have evolved in the private sector and well-established back and forth.
Thank you, Peter. Rohana.
Thank you very much. I think that's an excellent suggestion, and we'll take up on that. And with the assistance of NACA, MPDA will definitely do a documentation so that the lessons learned and wherever our failures and how we overcame that, we definitely do this documentation. And I hope that's included as a part of the recommendation.
Thank you. Thank you, Lena. Now, we've got a number of questions here. I think, Amra, you had one, Dr. Gupta, and then you down here. So we're up to about three, so that's all I can count to. So let's have those first.
You. Thank you, Rohan, for the nice presentation. You clearly say why these small-scale farmers are getting busted because of the very small profit margin. This situation created by the forces away from their control. The first time, the two cases that you talk about in the Thailand and the also Pangasius in Vietnam, the scientific discoveries, scientific finding, once the Pangasius start breeding by 2000, everybody getting into the bandwagon and produce an oversupply. And the SPF technology come here, everybody start producing shrimp price, boom, cash. Therefore, science sometimes do very bad thing for small scale farmers. Then again, the other problem is now the some of the seed supply are attached to the feed selling. For example, Thailand, one company provides very good shrimp meal to farmers with the condition that they have to buy their feed. Therefore, some small scale farmers survive in that way, the attached to some feed meal. I think we need to look at the whole picture. Therefore, I'm sure Mike will talk about private sector involvement in the next one. But there is some sort of linkage with horizontal linkage to link into the private sector companies also, because feed cost is the biggest cost. Then again, one day I think we say we want more fish, 30 million ton and all those things, but we are oversupplying, flooding the market. And small scale people are going down. Therefore, maybe one day we should have to think about aquaculture quota, same as a fishing quota, to protect these small scale farmers. Thank you.
That's a challenging sort of suggestion. maybe we won't debate that just yet. Dr. Gupta, you had a question there, I think, and then down at the front here.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk again. If you look at these so-called success stories from India, Indonesia, and elsewhere we have talked, we can identify two characteristics that has made them successful. One, these initiatives are funded by FAO or other international organization, along with the national institutions. Second, it's an export-oriented commodity, that is the shrimp. Now, if you look at the percentage of shrimp in the total global production, and we are talking the number of small farmers, what is the percentage of shrimp farmers in the total small-scale aquaculture farmers? That's one thing. The second thing, so basically we think that if this is to be successful, we need a government support on a long-term basis. I do agree with Dr. Imtiaz. A number of initiatives in the past have failed after the donor assistance or the technical assistance have been withdrawn. Let us not be pessimistic, but we have a very good example from India, the Gujarat Milk Producers Cooperative Association. It started with a few hundred milk producers. Now I think the membership runs into hundreds of thousands of milk producers, and it has revolutionized milk production in India. And now India is the largest producer of milk in the world, and what we call as white revolution. And this is sustaining not only their milk, but they're also producing about 30 to 40 products that are being sold domestically and also being exported. So what we need a recommendation from here, if these initiatives that have been shown success so far at least, need to be initiated by the government. A strong support is needed, a commitment is needed from the government to help these and sustain these small-scale farmers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Did you still want to retain your question?
Just a few words, Rohana. I would have liked to have seen in your title, in your presentation, the title of enabling rather than protecting small-scale aquaculturists, because I feel that protecting has been one of the areas that has made, in Latin America at least, fail most of the schemes that we have seen there. And we do not know all the stories because, as somebody said here, we do not account, we do not measure what we have done and what are the results that we have obtained in the past. I would like to see much more when we are talking about helping, when we are talking about enabling small aquacultures. I would like to see much more an evaluation, figures, concrete figures, what has been done and with what resources. I feel that in the part of the world that I come from, we would have been ashamed in the last 50 years if we account all the money that we have spent and the results we have been getting.
Thank you. You know, I think we'll have one more question from down there. Sorry. And I think we'll call the close there. Maybe we'll have time after David's presentation.
Thank you. I am Abdulhai from Iran. I have one question about Rohana. Thank you for your presentation. Did you, Rohana, compare with the aquaculture with the agriculture a small scale? And because in agriculture we have a many years experience or the smallest scale of the agriculture.
Thank you, Abdulhai. It's not an easy question to answer though, but we haven't really done a comparative study. But we did look at some of the environmental aspects of, you know, different commodity production systems between agriculture and between aquaculture. But my little experience, I can give you one example. When I was young, I grew up in a village with a lot of rice paddy. Now, we don't have. Why? Vietnamese rice is much cheaper to buy in the market than making your own rice in Sri Lanka. So that is, in my opinion, the same for all commodities. The corporate governance, the corporate sector is pushing basically small farmers, so you just can't make it anymore. Unless your government is going to give you some subsidy, a reasonable subsidy. Likewise, my government in Sri Lanka is now 100% subsidy for fertilizer by the government. Only way you keep a rice farmer running. Otherwise, you're out.
Okay, look, I think we're going to wrap the session up now. Rohan, would you like a concluding comment? Okay, well, I think we need to give David Little a talk, but let me just say thank you very much to the panel members and Dr. Rohana. Thank you. I think we've got at least three clear points of view for recommendations that have come through, Rohana, and I think the one is that social sustainability is an important part of sustainability. The second is the need for statistics on small-scale farmers. And the third is the support for government, for long-term support for governments, for clusters and associations. So I think... Okay, thank you very much. So an excellent talk. Thank you very much.